Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm very happy now to welcome Patricia Johansson. She is an artist. She will be speaking tonight at Tipton Hall on the campus of the College of Santa Fe. It's a lecture sponsored by the Santa Fe Art Institute. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So you do incredibly interesting work that involves art and the environment and human infrastructure. And your work is very much in service of nature and the restoration of ecosystems in the midst of all this crazy stuff that human beings have built. How did you start? How did you start on the path that you are on?
Well, actually, I was invited by House and Garden magazine in 1969 to design a garden. And I had never even thought about the landscape before. I was formally trained as a painter and a sculptor, and I was always interested in architecture, so large-scale structures. But when I started exploring the landscape, I realized not only how complex it is, but how every element fed into every other element. And one of the analogies I use, because if you've ever seen an old-fashioned pocket watch and you open up the back, it's as if every gear is turning every other gear. And so it isn't a matter of isolating one thing. It's how the whole structure works together. And that kind of became one of the clues to my work, that I never focus on one thing. I always try to focus on how everything is feeding into everything else. And at the time this started, of course, all the gardens were rejected. They were just, you know, very small, very bad drawings on scraps of typing paper, so 8.5 by 11, nothing very prepossessing, and really not very good drawings. They were just totally about ideas. The program was really, of course, this was the heyday of the environmental movement, and so I began to just take problems and try to solve them using art as part of the process, because, of course, that was my training as an artist. So looking at the environmental problem, but also looking at how to solve the problem, not just to comment on the problem, which everyone was doing, but to actually make it better. And then another aspect of it was to allow people to enter into the dialogue by creating these solutions as public spaces. So it became almost like a piece of environmental art where you would take the art parts, the color, the structure, the form, and then invite people inside the work of art and at the same time think about wildlife, other creatures, not just humans, you know, not just an anthropocentric point of view. And so that's how I got started. And, of course, there was no real context in the art world for anything like that at the time. So, you know, it was not successful.
It's interesting that you use the analogy of the pocket watch, because that's a human creation with lots of gears. But when I look at your work, it seems like it's so much inspired by nature, and not only understanding, I think there's a quotation in your book, not just being inspired by how things look, but trying to understand how they work and looking at the engineering of plants themselves and how they do what they do and using that as a starting place.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And the interesting thing is there are no bad designs in nature, because if they were bad, they wouldn't succeed. And that almost goes back to Darwin. So you can look at any piece of nature and analyze it and see how it's working. But the other part of nature is that it's constantly transforming. And that is really the difference between art and life. When I was an art student, what we were told is you wanted perfect form, you wanted something such that nothing could be added, nothing could be detracted without absolutely ruining the work of art. So you had this ideal creation with the artist as God, you know. I mean, we really thought of Michelangelo and Corbusier and that grand tradition, you know, the classical work of art. Whereas this is just the opposite. Once you allow the living world to enter, you know that there's only a momentary perfection, and then it changes. And so for me, it's not that there is an ideal world out there. It's that there's a very practical and functional world that can be supportive to people, to wildlife. It doesn't need to pollute the environment. And then the other aspect, of course, at this juncture of my career, is there's a great deal of public money that goes into built structures, these, you know, highway interchanges and, oh, you know, just, you see it everywhere. And the engineers just don't understand that there's a living world out there. Their solution is always to cut down the trees, you know, to widen the road, and in the end, to make everything worse, because engineering projects tend to get bigger and more sterile, you know, the more money you put into them. So one of the things I've tried to do is work with engineers, take these millions of dollars, and convert their structures into something that's really useful to people beyond what the bald purpose is, you know, to add another lane to the highway kind of thing. And this has really become a passion with me because, for example, in Petaluma now, we have a 600-acre park where there could have been just a sewage treatment plant with a chain-link fence around it. And there are just countless examples of situations like that. And so those are some of the issues that are really important to me.
As I was reading your book, I found myself, it's interesting that you say that you're working with engineers in that way, because I found myself thinking, this person, Patricia Johansson, really should be teaching at engineering schools. And one of the reasons, one of the many reasons for that is that they tend more and more to use straight lines and right angles because they use computer-aided design machines, and it's much easier to, you know, when you're using a CAD system, make a straight line than make a curved line. When I was looking at the designs that you have done, both the photographs of the finished project and your drawings, it doesn't seem like there's a straight line anywhere in it. You're really engaging nature's forms and working with nature rather than against it.
Well, it's, you know, it's really true. But actually, this, when I went to architecture school in the early 70s, it was like that. I used to make drawings by hand, not with a T-square. And my teachers would come over and they would put an X on my drawings and write NG, meaning no good. And so the mere fact that the hand was present made it no good. And that is definitely the mentality. The other issue in the practical world is, you know, one of the reasons engineers do everything by the book is, you know, the liability issue. So you don't want to do anything new and innovative, because if you do, you leave yourself open to criticism. You haven't acted in a professional manner. And the way to act in a professional manner is to go back to the book and see how things have always been done. So while that may not, you know, be a trend-setting way to act, that is the way they are always going to act. And I have, on these projects, I have to fight for everything I get. It's not easy. And so actually the way I accomplish that is through the political process. When you go out and talk to the people and say, look, you could have a park here. You could actually have animals in it. You know, you could have hiking trails. Then the public wants it, and they will go out to public meetings and demand that there be a design that incorporates these things. And that's how I've always operated. Again, the analogy of, you know, not just a single straight line trajectory of how to act in the world, but to try to figure out what all the forces are, you know, and how they can come together to achieve a solution that people really want. Because in the end, we're the users. It's our tax money.
Right.
You know?
Well, let's talk about the Petaluma project, because, as you say, it could have been a sewage treatment project with a chain link fence around it, but instead it is a model for ecological restoration and human use and all sorts of things at the same time. Tell us about the process and what finally ended up in Petaluma.
Well, you know, basically, I was on the value engineering team one of the members with pretty much traditional engineering firm who had never done a wetlands facility before. There was one other member of the value engineering team, Bob Gearhart from Humboldt State University, and he had worked on a predecessor plant in Arcata, California. And basically, we just never gave up pushing the wetlands scenario. At that point, when there were seven design alternatives with all sorts of mechanical solutions, you know, dissolved air flotation devices and on, we actually went to the city council and made the presentation of the wetlands facility. And that weekend, in one of the existing parks in Petaluma, I forget if it was 3,000 or 5,000 or 6,000 signatures. It's on their website. In one weekend, that's what they got in favor of the wetlands plan. And then, in addition, there was a newspaper, a local newspaper, the Petaluma Argus Courier, that began writing articles, editorials, saying that this was a wonderful solution. And, you know, how many other benefits there would be besides the treatment of sewage, that it was an economic development project that would bring people to Petaluma. It was going to add 3 miles of trails that people could walk. It was going to preserve all the wildlife and attract more. It was going to become a major site on the Pacific Flyway. So basically, they started taking the narrative that I had developed and getting it out in the local press. And when this happened, really, the city council could not do anything except vote for the wetland solution, which they did. And so that was the facility that was selected.
So the wetlands, tell us actually how it works, the relationship between sewage treatment and the wetlands and the park and the whole thing.
Well, you know, basically, what happens is the sewage comes in a traditional manner, you know, and it basically comes into the facility. It goes through a headworks, which is typical, where they remove things like plastic bottles and grit removal and things that would basically, you would not want in your finished product, the water. At that point, the water goes into oxidation ponds where it settles. And these are very, very large ponds. There are over 100 acres of these ponds. And basically, it's just retained there for a while, so the solids settle out. And then it goes through what's called densely vegetated treatment wetlands. And this is basically bulrushes. And one of the things I've become particularly interested in recently has been how each species of wetland plant does certain jobs for you. And they have each one has certain chemical secretions that allow specific microbes and insects to coexist there. And basically, all of this whole little ecosystem that you're developing is doing the job of cleaning the water. So what happens is your pollutants are removed. A lot of them are consumed. The plants are pumping oxygen into, you know, these submerged stems and roots and tubers, and that they in turn are supplying these microbial decomposers. So you're basically developing a whole little ecosystem of plants and animals. Many of them can only be seen with, say, a scanning electron microscope. But these are the guys that are cleaning the water. Okay, and then, of course, these dense filters are also filtering out the detritus and so on. So it goes to the densely vegetated treatment wetlands, and then it comes back and flows by gravity down through the mouse ponds. And the mouse ponds are basically your polishing wetlands. And within that, when people look at this image of the mouse, basically every element there is a very functional element. So, for example, the eyes of the mouse, those islands are nesting islands for waterfowl. But they're also directing the flow of water as it flows through the basin. And then each pond is divided into several areas. Where you see the plants, that's the part that's doing the filtering. Where you see the open water, that there you're getting sunlight, you're getting oxygenation from the algae that are growing there. You're also getting wave action, which further oxygenates the water. And then it will go back into the filters again, and you'll screen the algae out. And basically, after it goes through this process, this is the only point at which it's pumped. It's pumped up toward the highway. It's disinfected, and then it goes into the recycled water ponds. And then that recycled water is used to irrigate crops, and in fact, organic crops that are right on the other side of the highway. So you can see the sewage on one side of the road. You have the sewage coming in, and then on the other side, you have this clean water going out to water these crops, including vineyards, including, you know, some very expensive wines. So,
did you have to get over the mental block that using human sewage that would eventually turn into irrigation water was going to be bad for you?
No, I don't, because there's only a certain amount of water on the planet, and it's the same water. It's really just a matter of, you know, I mean, when water condensed, you know, from when the Earth was born, and that's the water we have, and this same water is the same water that's passing through our bodies, you know. I mean, the dinosaurs drank it. It's the same water. So the water, you know, has a very long history. But so basically for me the issue is the water clean or polluted? Not, you know, what state is it in right now, but can we make it better? And I know that's hard for a lot of people to get over, but believe me, they will.
Well, that's I don't mean you personally. I mean in the political process of getting this through and using the water in that way.
Not in California. You know, one of the joys of working in California is the people there are very smart and very environmentally conscious. So you really don't have to educate them. They already are. You know, they know about these things. So there, it's not difficult.
The thing that I find so striking about your project, this one in particular is a great example, is that, I mean, a lot of the time when you look at environmental pollution and degradation, I think, human beings are just ruining our habitat, and why don't we just go away or reduce our population drastically so that the habitat that our environment can be restored. This is an example of human beings using the lowest tech solution possible, namely nature itself, to do the work for us and coexisting in a way that is really apparently sustainable.
Well, you know, I think we have to try. I mean, I agree that the scariest thing to me, and I remember the early days of, you know, Paul Ehrlich going on the Johnny Carson show and talking about, you know, zero population growth and how this was at the heart of every environmental problem. And I really do believe that, you know, if we can't get the population under control, at some point we're going to run out of luck. But on the other hand, we are also a throwaway society, and we often aren't as clever about finding solutions as we could be. And, you know, I think particularly in an urban setting, there's a lot of throwaway land. There are a lot of vacant lots. There are a lot of, you know, blighted neighborhoods. There are a lot of resources that could be made much, much better if we, you know, would approach them in a more multifunctional way than we currently do. We're too prone to throw things away and not use them and not see all the possibilities within them. So I'm always very attracted to derelict sites because I figure they have more possibilities, you know, than someplace that's already wonderful.
Tell us about your work creating the Rocky Marciano trail and project in Massachusetts.
Well, that was actually really difficult because, I sometimes tend to overreach and be too ambitious. I really wanted to take the whole city, you know, and make it function ecologically. And because the city was so derelict when I was there, it seemed like really a golden opportunity. And then...
Now, what city was this again?
Brockton.
Brockton, Massachusetts. Right. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, and I, you know, I kept... The city, I mean, what the mayor had done was basically go through, and there were a lot of drug dealers and things, and basically he demolished buildings. And so, you know, there were huge parts of the fabric of the city that were just gone. They were, you know, lots filled with crushed brick and broken glass. And you look around, you know, it's something like that, and you're an artist, and you think, okay, the Massachusetts Cultural Council invited me to do this. What were they thinking? So, but the thing is, there were all kinds of issues. There were flooding issues from, you know, putting those malls, those huge suburban malls in the wrong spot, and then all that runoff went into the river. I mean, there were things that were really very obvious to me. And then to be able to take all of these vacant lots and give them back to nature, I realized that, you know, you could really make this, you know, make this city a kind of combination of urban and ecological that didn't exist anywhere else because there was so much derelict territory. But I have to tell you, that project was not a success in my terms because these people were the exact opposite of the folks in California. They didn't get it, and they didn't see why this would even be valuable. You know, their idea was, I don't know what, to attract more people to Brockton, but how could you, you know, given what Brockton was? And but the thing is, I was trying to find something there that I could work with. And one day I was walking around and somebody told me that this was Rocky Marciano's house. And of course, I knew nothing about boxing at the time. I didn't, you know, I wasn't really interested, but I just knew that he was an important person. So I managed to meet his brother, Peter. And Peter started giving me all the family photographs, which were just wonderful. And then I heard the story about this young man, you know, who had no education. His father had worked in the shoe factory. And it's the one thing his father told him, which my grandmother told me the same thing, is he said, never go into a factory. And so the story really resonated with me. This young man who had no resources, he came home. He took his old Navy sea bag, which was the only education he had, was the Navy, you know, filled it with wood chips and started punching it in the backyard. And everybody laughed at him. And what he did in order to train, because he couldn't really afford a trainer, is he started running through the streets of Brockton. And he started running through all the neighborhoods. And as he did, people would actually throw things at him. They would throw garbage at him and say, don't come here. Because Brockton was walled off into different enclaves, different ethnic groups. And at that time, the Italians were not supposed to go into these other better parts of town, the better neighborhoods or the golf course. And so he did this run every day through all the streets of Brockton. And for me, that became the unifying theme, that you could take this city, you know, and use Rocky's running route to kind of bring all of these different ethnic groups together. And they're different. They're different now. But that still existed, this kind of like medieval scheme of you can only go here, but you can't go there. Again, that was not popular in Brockton. They didn't want any mixing, even then. So, you know, I don't consider the project very successful, but I tried. I tried to change their mind.
We're talking to artist Patricia Johansson. She's going to be at the Santa Fe Art Institute's talk at 6 o'clock tonight at Tipton Hall. One thing that I found interesting in this book, which was written about you and your work, called Art and Survival by Kathryn Kelly, was that she was writing about how you have three children and that for you, motherhood became kind of a metaphor about creation in the sense that you create these young people and put them out into the world, and at a certain point you really don't have control, and that you see your artworks out in nature in a similar manner.
Yeah, I did. That's absolutely true. And of course, first of all, it's a prime example of multitasking, and I think everybody does it now. But when I did it, it was considered that if you had a child, you were not supposed to work. If you were a woman, you were supposed to devote yourself to the child and not try to be anything else, which is silly because, I mean, motherhood is among the best training I know for anything. It really tells you what's important. It also, for the type of work I do, which is public spaces, it tells you how people act in them, how real people act in them, including children. It makes you very safety conscious. As a public artist, I always have to be aware of not designing anything that could be dangerous or could hurt people. You know, I do a lot of projects that include water, but nobody ever drowns in them. I'm knocking on wood. Because, you know, they're designed to be safe. And I actually think about this. I think about what a 2-year-old would do and what a 6-year-old would do, you know, and what a couple of 12-year-old boys who are horsing around would do. So, for example, in Dallas, when I did those paths over water, even though the lagoon is 18 feet deep, there's a little continental shelf under those paths. So if somebody falls in, it's only, you know, 12 to 18 inches deep. They step right back out on the path. And that's always part of my thinking. So I think, you know, having children is really, you know, a really very good thing.
So there are those concerns. But then there's also this other thing which comes into it, which is that when you create a work, a public, I guess you would call it artwork, environmental space, it starts evolving and it does things that surprise you or that you didn't plan and that change over time as your own children do.
Yeah, that's true. And part of what you do as a designer is you try to think of where it's going to go from here and try to plan that in to the extent that you can. I do try to design projects that require minimum maintenance. But, you know, depending on the situation, for example, in the early work that I did, I don't maintain things at all. And even though some of that work now is 40 years old, it still looks great. I mean, it may not look the way it used to look, but in a way, that's like a person. I mean, you don't love your grandmother any less because she's getting older, you know. And so things don't look pristine at a certain point. But again, for me, that's not a problem. If you're designing a public park, for example, then you really do need to be concerned about maintenance in terms of that the thing is still safe. But beyond that, I don't go. I don't try to hold things in place. I do care less about the image than about how it's used and whether basically it's a positive force in the world or a negative force. And so those are the questions that I ask.
Tell us about the work you did in Dallas.
Well, that was actually the first large project I ever did. And I had an exhibit of drawings on 57th Street in New York City, in an art gallery, actually. And this man came in and looked at the drawings, and he called me up, and he said, are these buildable projects? And I said, oh, yes. Yes, of course, that's what the drawings are about. And it was Harry Parker, who was director of the Dallas Museum of Art, and he said, we must have one for Dallas. And so about a year or two later, he invited me down to Dallas, and he showed me what he called his old mud hole, which was this polluted lagoon right in the middle of a large public park. And he said, do you think you could do anything with this? And I said, well, yes. And I said, what is the budget? And he just looked at me, and he said, well, there is no budget. He said, just do what you think needs to be done. He said, this is Dallas. If they like it, they'll build it. And I've never had anybody say anything like that to me before or
That's
since.
Amazing.
And so I designed the ideal project. I cleaned up the lagoon in terms of the plantings. I created access to the water for people. I stopped the shoreline erosion by actually placing the paths out in the water to break up the wave action. And then I created paths across the lagoon so people wouldn't have to walk all the way around. You know, and then I worked with the Dallas Museum of Natural History on what kind of microhabitats we could create within the sculpture so that, you know, animals would actually live there. When I came, there was nothing. The lagoon was declared biologically dead. There was nothing living in the water. And then we turned it into a flood basin, a municipal flood basin. So the level of the water actually goes up and down. And interestingly enough, I was there at the dedication, which was close to 25 years ago. And then I visited again last year, and there had been a huge rainstorm, and the sculpture was covered with water, and it looked so beautiful. It looked much, much better than when it was new. And there were some people there, and of course they didn't know I had designed it, and so they wanted to show me all the animals. And this man fished out an enormous snapping turtle out of the lagoon to show to me. And what I realized was, of course, animals have been migrating in ever since. What we did was we created something that could function for the city. It was holding the water. This was also playing into the aesthetic, because one of the reasons it looks so beautiful is you could see the reflections of the trees on top of some of the sculpture, which was underwater. And the way I designed the paths, of course, the sculptural flow, was that when parts of the path got covered, there would always be other routes. So there would be like stepping stone routes. So you could still get across the lagoon, but you'd have to take a different path. And to me, that's very important, is that this sense of nature transforming all the time, that there is something permanent, there are these permanent threads, but that nature is also flowing through the project and being allowed a life of its own that you're not controlling. Like the snapping turtle that I'm sure nobody wants there, but, you know, he's managed to be there. And I think that's great. You know.
It also illustrates something which I think is very important, which is that if you create spaces that are biologically potentially active, they become active just all on their own. You don't have to import snapping turtles from a zoo or something like that. They just show up.
You know what? This is absolutely true. And I learned this years and years ago when I worked in San Francisco on the sewer. And they had all of these experts that were making a very good living, basically working hand in glove with developers. They'd destroy a wetland on one hand, and then they would do mitigation. So these expert restorers, wetland restoration people, would put a wetland in, but you know what? They never worked. The plants always died. They never succeeded. And one of the things that I've learned is that let nature choose. And so in a way, I just try to frame nature, but I don't try to determine. I have a sense of what will come, what will be there, and I work with that. But I don't have a sense of what the ideal is. I just want success. And nature has to achieve its own success. Basically, all I'm doing is framing it and making it accessible to people. But what is, interestingly enough, all of these, like, wetlands restorations that failed, what was discovered subsequently was that you could take up a parking lot, you know, that had been placed over a wetland, and the seeds were still in the ground. That wetland would come back, because that wetland had always been there, and that was its home, and that's where it wanted to be. And so that, I think that is a really important lesson, is don't try to put things, you know, where they don't belong. And don't try to make nature's decisions for it, you know.
Right.
Because we don't understand. We don't have a deep enough understanding of how all these tiny parts work.
We're talking to artist Patricia Johansson. Do you take your inspiration from, for example, past civilizations that also worked closely with nature but also had highly developed human civilizations?
Yes, yes. And the other thing is, I'm always, whenever I do a project, I think the local, the people who have lived in a place, I always try to spend a lot of time with them because they know in ways that I will never know. Just from having lived there, just from having seen things. And one of the things is we have so many agencies now who want to decide and regulate and tell, you know, what is possible. And it's as if they know. And, you know, as far as I'm concerned, they don't know. And a kind of classic example is when I was working in San Francisco, I wanted to restore the oyster beds, the shellfish beds in San Francisco Bay. And there were several agencies that told me that I couldn't do that because I would be placing fill in the bay. And I said, but it's not fill. I mean, these are things that have always been there. And, you know, you'll attract a whole new group of birds, like oyster catchers and, you know, birds that like a firmer substrate. They don't want to sink into the bay mud. And it was an absolute stonewall. No, you can't do it. You're placing fill in the bay. I later talked to some Native Americans, and they just laughed. And they said, well, we told them that years ago. They said, you know, when these agencies, I think they were meaning U.S. Fish and Wildlife, they said, you know, when these agencies took over, they told us we couldn't harvest the oysters. And they told us that this was now the property of the U.S. government and we couldn't trespass, that this was, you know, these shellfish were owned by the public. And so they said, and we told them the oysters would die, but they didn't believe us. Well, the truth is, you know, now that the science has been done, that's exactly why they did die, is because they weren't harvested. Because when people went out and took some, you know, and ate them, they were basically stirring up the mud so it didn't settle over these shellfish beds and suffocate them all, which is what happened. And so I think, you know, it's an object lesson that we do need to listen to that kind of wisdom that isn't necessarily scientifically framed, but that people know, you know, in their bones from generations back what's going to happen.
Well, and they know it empirically from generations back. It's just that science hasn't caught up with them in a lot of cases.
Yeah. So those are all the, you know, those are all the issues that you really have to, you know, have to work with. You have to work with, you know, whatever the conventional scientific wisdom is, I put wisdom in quotes, at the time. You know, because that's always changing too. You know, what we think one day isn't what, you know, what the policy is the next day.
Well, and Lord knows there have been just countless numbers of disasters that have come about because of science introducing non-native species to an area for what they think are very good reasons. And we haven't come out of that yet. We're still in all of those same arguments.
Very true.
I find it fascinating that you work with biologists, conservationists, public planners, city politicians, and you are an artist, and somehow your art is not only the design, but really or at least that's how it looks to me, working with all of these people together and bringing them together to kind of co-create these spaces.
You know, it's really true, because we all have our expertise, and we know things from a certain angle. And basically, because I'm trained as an artist, I know how to design something that will incorporate people's ideas and what they want to see, how they want a space to function, you know, what they want to happen there, what groups they want to bring together. Because I'm particularly interested in plants and animals and wildlife and in keeping them going, because we've, you know, taken so much of their territory. So to be able to recreate that wildlife habitat wherever I can and link it up, that's one of my issues that's really important to me. But basically, it's a matter of giving a voice to this great mix of people, all of whom, you know, have a certain interest in a given project.
We have here the Bioneers, whom you may know here in New Mexico. And one of the things that I see in common with their work and your work is that you are creating models for how people could do things that are economic models that could be so much cheaper and more efficient than the way we're doing things now. And I wonder if some of the things you've done have caught on and spread to other cities and other artists and other planners?
You know, I really think they have. And I think the Bioneers have also been very key in that, because they do, you know, they do invite artists every year. I know I spoke there in California, in Marin, some years ago, but I, you know, many of my friends are, they're stalwarts, and so, you know, I do follow their activities, and I think they're really important. And, yes, I think these ideas do spread, but we need to hope that they spread a little faster, because, you know, it just seems as if we're always losing ground. That may not be true, but, you know, I think the sooner we can act responsibly, the better. And the more people we can get to do so, the better. And the more it becomes a matter of public policy, the better. So, yeah, I'm all for the Bioneers.
Yeah, well, and I think what's interesting is in moments of economic hardship, like the one we're in now, it may be that some of these ideas catch on more quickly because ultimately they would save money.
Well, you know, in a way, it's our. I think tough economic times are our salvation. Here in the East, the only cities that are intact are ones that are too poor, you know, so that the developers haven't been interested in knocking the old buildings down, and now they become very valuable as like Hollywood stage sets. So people come to cities like Troy and Saratoga all the time to make movies because they're the only places left. But in the case of Troy, it's the poverty that made that happen, that nobody was interested in the place. So, I don't think hard times are bad. I think they throw us back to what's really important, you know, community, how we live our lives, our family. I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing. And I think, you know, most of us are resilient enough and clever enough to survive them. So, I'm not worried.
You were diagnosed with supposedly terminal cancer over 20 years ago, and I wondered, first of all, how you survived and how that survival and healing affected your work.
You know, it's so hard, and I think one of the things about cancer is you need to have something that you really want to live for. And, of course, I had young children. And, you know, when I was told that, it was so shocking to me because I wasn't sick. I really had just gone in for a routine checkup, and they had discovered 32 enlarged lymph nodes. And then the news, of course, got worse and worse and worse after that. But, you know, I told my mother, and I was crying, and she just said to me, "What's the matter with you?" She said, "Why do you believe them?" I just looked at her and said, "But they're doctors." She said, "Doctors don't know everything." She said, "You've never been like everybody else. You've never trusted what people told you. Why start now?" She said, let's just go out and find somebody that will, you know, treat you." And, you know, that wasn't easy. That wasn't easy to even find somebody who would treat me because, you know, they didn't consider me worth it. But in the end, we did find somebody, and I had two years of treatments, and my parents were wonderful. They took care of me. They took care of my children. Everybody moved, you know, to New York. So we did it, and I think it's that kind of combination of having something that where you really do, your back is against the wall, and you really do need to succeed, but then also having that kind of loving support around you. And if you have that, it's everything. But yeah, and nobody knows, even my beloved doctor who did treat me has no idea why I'm still here. But he did say to me that I'm one of two people that has made him never turn anybody down, no matter how bad they are, that I've taught him that he does not know everything and that he's always willing to try. So, you know, go figure.
I was reading once about how a cancer tumor works, and one of the things about it that makes it lethal is that, or potentially lethal, is that whereas the rest of our cells in our bodies know when to reproduce and when they don't need to reproduce, whereas these cancer cells have unchecked growth. And when you look at them, they make their own blood supplies, they make their own kind of little infrastructures, and for all the world, they remind me of sort of unchecked capitalist growth and unchecked real estate development. And I've often wondered if we could somehow find the cure for both of those things, whether they wouldn't be similar in some way.
You know, I think that's such a great analogy. And actually, when you look at them, I mean, I didn't know anything about cancer before I had it, but I too became interested. And when you just look at them visually, they're like little fortresses, you know. They
yeah.
build the supply of blood vessels around them so that they become, you know, impenetrable.
Right.
And it is just amazing. You know, it is a lot like the too big to fail. Like, you know, we have to protect these guys because, you know, what other choice do we have? Everything will, you know, they've made themselves so much, you know, so invincible that even if you don't want to help them, you're stuck helping them. That's been the argument, right?
So, yeah, and then and the medical analogy is they end up killing everybody else and themselves.
Yeah, yeah, it is. Well, I'm with you on that one. You know, I think they have, just in terms of medicine, I think there have been a lot of advances in terms of the kind of combination chemotherapy, which is very interesting because they don't, you know, they'll use multiple drugs, I guess on the theory that if one thing doesn't work, something else will or whatever. But it does become like a whole little ecosystem that they're targeting at these, you know, unwanted unwanted growth.
We've got just a minute or two left, but I wanted to ask you before we go. I was thinking, I remember when I was in college and studying art history and going to museums and looking at art and thinking about beauty and then going into nature and looking at something as apparently simple as a flower or the inside of a walnut and thinking that beauty was so much greater than anything I had just seen in the museum or a tree or a cave and things like that. And I wondered how your sense of beauty had changed and evolved given the kind of work that you do.
Well, it really has. And basically, I agree with you 100% because when you go to a museum and you look at something, when you look at a man-made composition, it may have that perfect balance and so on. But what it lacks is the other part. If you look at a walnut, it's not just beautiful visually, but it also, you begin to play into all of the functional and structural considerations, what that walnut really is, what it needs to do, and why it looks the way it does look. And if you look at any piece of nature, you can begin to ask those questions and see how perfect the structure is, not just in terms of form, but in terms of strategy, in terms of survival, in terms of its place in the world, in terms of its perpetuating itself. So it becomes, each composition becomes a whole world that's very multifaceted, not like that work on canvas where somebody made some decisions, and it may be very beautiful and the colors may be wonderful, and it may give a lot of aesthetic pleasure, but it doesn't have the layers of meaning that any piece of nature has.
Patricia Johansson is an artist. She will be in Santa Fe tonight speaking at Tipton Hall at 6 o'clock. It's part of the Santa Fe Art Institute's series. You can reach the Santa Fe Art Institute at 505-424-5050. And you can also find them online at sfai.org. And you can find more about Patricia's work at patriciajohansson.com. Thank you so much for being with us, and I hope you get to, it would be so wonderful if you ended up doing a project here in New Mexico.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I look forward to meeting you.
Excellent. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, we'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.